All right, I think we should start. So, okay. Well, thanks everybody for joining on Father's Day, and happy Father's Day to you guys on the call here that are fathers. I will start us off with prayer and then we'll just jump in. There's a lot to cover today, so kind of an exciting century. I mean, they're all exciting, but this one has a lot of stuff. So let me open up with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you again for this day, for your word, and just for the opportunity to gather in the morning and again through Zoom. We thank you that you're a God of history, Lord. You have been faithful from beginning till now and forever, Lord. And we thank you for the ways we can see how you've worked and see the good and the bad, God, into just testimony of our sinfulness and our fallenness, and yet your goodness and your sustaining power to guide us even as human beings have constantly needed your intervention and help, Lord. So just pray for today, this as we learn these things about the what has happened in the 19th century, that it would be encouraging to us, that we would learn certain things that would be applicable for our own lives, that we would take heart and be encouraged from the things that did happen, and also be convicted of ways that things that may have not been optimal, and we would also learn from those mistakes as well. So thank you for those that's gone before us, and we thank you and bless this time. Guide me as I teach, help me to have clarity of thought and clarity of speech, and we pray all this in your son's name. Amen. Okay, so sorry guys, I'm going to be looking up a little bit since I have a screen up here, so hopefully that's okay with you guys. So I might not be able to see you guys. Okay, so we're going to start off. So basically there is a lot of people I put on the notes here on the first page. There's a lot of notable people in this century, and this includes people like Napoleon, Abraham Lincoln, Wilberforce, and then missionaries. You can see those names up there, Hudson Taylor, John Patton, William Carey. I'm going to be talking about some of those. And then Spurgeon, you know, most people know Spurgeon. And then philosophers, theologians, and certain scientists. Of course, Charles Darwin being a huge one. So we'll cover just briefly some of that stuff. I put in some of the movements of the century. This was basically, some have said the 19th century was the century of isms. Like there's a lot of isms. There's liberalism, nationalism, romanticism, socialism, Marxism. There's a lot of isms. And so there was a lot of stuff going on in different parts of the world. And so we will cover some of those things. And there was a lot of changes as well in theology, and things that were formally accepted now we're starting to get challenged, and so we will talk about that towards the end. And some events, some of you guys might have heard the Great Awakening. There was not just one, there was at least two, some would say three or four, depends on what you depends on the source, but there are some that say there's up to four Great Awakenings, but this one was the second Great Awakening in the U.S., and there was a revival in Europe as well. And a lot of that actually coincided with a lot of revolutions that were going on in different countries. So we're going to start off first in Europe, then I'm going to transition to America. And so we'll kind of go from there. So if you look here on the bottom, we're going to start out with France. And 2 weeks ago, Tim had covered a little bit of this, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but basically there was a French Revolution that started in 1989 with the storming of the Bastille. And the motto of the French Revolution was liberty, equality, and fraternity. And we'll see, basically these things shook the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church, remember, had been in charge and in power for about 1,000 years. And this was something that was a big challenge, because what it did was it started giving power back to the people, or at least that's what the people wanted. And so it basically, they decried a lot of the disparities between the rich and the poor, the wealthy and the common people. And so honestly, there was a little bit of possibly some influence from the American Revolution, which, as you guys know, happened 15 years prior to this. So there may have been some overlap in influence as well in from America. So basically, there was what they call the elevation of the cult of reason. And essentially, it's kind of like a temporary de-Christianization, if you want to call it that way. It was kind of like a state-sponsored atheism. And so a lot of these churches became temples of reason. There's the women that dressed up as goddesses of reason, and some of them were pretty provocative. And even like the big cathedral, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, had the goddess of reason there. And they took down the Christian altars and a lot of these different Christian, objects and replaced them with other more secular things. So they replaced it with an altar of liberty, for example. And so this cult of reason basically dominated for not too long, but just for a few years. And pretty soon, actually, Napoleon took power. And so he took power and he actually pretty much kind of got rid of it, these cults, essentially. And he, surprisingly, he actually worked out an agreement with the Pope and restored the Church of Rome to a special place, but it wasn't ever back to the same place that it was in the past. And so basically one of the things that we saw on here is liberty. So liberty of the motto, liberty, equality, and fraternity, right? So there's this movement called classical liberalism. And what this was, it pervaded Europe by the mid 19th century. So 1848 or so. And it's called, I put classical in parentheses because it's a little bit different from American liberalism. And so it's a little bit confusing. And I'm going to cover a little bit later on kind of more of the American liberalism part, but think about this question. And I guess you can answer too. So if I said there's a certain group of people that doesn't want the government involved in many things, they want the government out. In our society, do we call that conservatives or do we call that liberals?
Conservatives.
Sorry?
Conservatives.
Right, exactly. So we see a lot of times we think conservatives means small government. Liberals means like, oh, we want government involvement. We want them to, help with a lot of these social issues. But what's confusing is that's not what classical liberalism is. Classical liberalism says everyone should just be free as possible. So you can see how that would pervade in a lot of different realms. So here I put individual realm. So basically everyone has right to their own opinions. Everyone can propagate them however they want, live according to them, and everyone should have that same ability. And then now the church has no right to insist its views on public morality. So just remember prior to this point, right, the Catholic Church, a lot of times there was a mixing of state influence and church influence. Of course, as we've covered in the last few centuries, that started to be broken down. But this was more kind of just an open declaration of the church. You have no right over public morality. And then the government is basically supposed to protect the civil liberties and all to have freedom to worship and freedom to vote, freedom to do anything. So people just hated the idea of being constrained. And just notably too, this is somewhat different from what the ancients would have thought. Like in Greek, like Aristotle's time, they used to think that liberalism, to be as free as possible, means you can be free as possible to live according to your nature or to your potential. And anything that would impede that, remove that, right? And so, but what this liberalism is, it's actually different. It means you can kind of do what you want. And you see how that's totally different, actually. It's more like you don't have to live to your potential. It's just you choose what you like and you do it, right? And you can see a lot of that influence. And I'm sure you guys can see that in our culture nowadays, in American culture, in the way we think. A lot of people just want to be free and hate constraint on anything. And so that was kind of what was going on in France at that time. And again, not just France, but it pervaded a lot of Europe. So I guess any questions on that before I move to it? Yeah.
I do. Yeah. Just to amplify that, Jimmy, because I think that's a helpful distinction. So you're saying like the Greeks would say they would advocate for liberties, but within constraints of nature. So like gender. They would say the ideal human existence is to be the best man you can be if you're a man.
Right.
Whereas there might be the seeds of, in this more modern liberalism, to decide whether you want to be a man or a woman, yeah, kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I would say that's true. Yeah. In that realm, and I'm sure in other societal realms and other demographic. Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. That's a good example. Okay. So basically, next is Italy here. Now, Italy, where, you know, Italy, of course, is where the Pope was. And this Pope, his name was Pope Pius IX. He was in 1846 to 1878. So he was originally welcomed in when he took office as kind of a liberal. So again, liberal in this term of liberalism, he was like for the people and gave some freedoms. And so people were happy about that. But there was a little bit of conflict where one of the high officials got assassinated by the people. And so he changed his stance. And so then people didn't like that. And so there started beginning some conflict. And his stance and his rule was over the Papal States. So if you guys remember, the Papal States is basically just the territories under the Pope's jurisdiction. And so there was some conflict, and eventually there was and during this time there was a lot of nationalism of the Italians were very gung-ho about their own culture, but there was also French influence and other things. So they wanted to throw all that off. And what happened is then these nationalists kind of rose up, and it was pretty much a revolution. And then they ended up installing a king and everything, and eventually took over the Papal States as well. And so at this point, Italy is kind of like being taken over, but Rome is still standing with some protection from France, but then eventually that falls too. And so officially after that, Rome fell, it was officially over for 1,000 years. The Papal States was over. There was no more Papal States. And so what happened is the Pope withdrew to the Vatican. And so that's why nowadays there is the Vatican City, which is, you know, a small region within Italy that the Pope has jurisdiction over. And so at this point, when he withdrew to the Vatican, you know, he still was basically resisting, obviously. And the king had offered the Pope a kind of some concessions, say, hey, I'll give you a subsidy, or, you know, you can still do all your spiritual functions there. But he was not having any of that. You know, he didn't feel like the king should dictate what could and could not happen. And so this conflict actually lasted for a while, until 1929, when I think Mussolini or someone got, I think it was Mussolini got involved. And basically after this, the Pope renounced all claim to any of the Papal States, and his sovereignty just is strictly over the Vatican. So the Vatican now is an independent country state within Italy. And so there are some other significant Catholic beliefs that actually came out of this. Now, this was all within the French atmosphere, during the French Revolution, kind of this whole, all this chaos that was going on. A lot of Catholics thought, you know what, the Pope is the only source of civil order and public morality, and the Pope is the one that can restore all this disorder that's been going on. And so just as kings have sovereignty over the state and things like that, the church should have sovereignty in some ways, or is a monarchy in some ways, over the spiritual realm. And so this Pope then declared war on all these things that were going on. So he declared war on socialism, on rationalism, he didn't, you know, on freedom of the press, freedom of separation of church and state. So he was totally against all that, because those were products of like liberalism that were rising up. And so two different concepts you guys may have heard, or two different beliefs within the Catholic, two significant Catholic doctrines were established at this point. And one of them was 1854, the Immaculate Conception. Does anybody know what that means, Immaculate Conception? Okay. Well, basically what it was is the Pope declared Mary, Mother of Jesus, to be conceived without original sin. And he declared this in 1854, which, and his declaration was what they called ex cathedra. Ex cathedra means from the chair. Okay. And so meaning he determined it and not from any council, he just said it. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit here soon. But with that, he again wanted to establish the power and the primacy of the Pope, the papacy. And so he called a council, actually called a council in 1865. And then a few years later, they convened and they actually, he wanted them to all vote on papal infallibility. Okay. So actually the majority of the people that attended were in favor of this doctrine of papal infallibility. There was some oppositions. And what interestingly, they did a revote after the first vote. And it ended up, of course, that then a lot of the people that actually dissented actually, they either withdrew or there was some compromise that happened. So eventually they established papal infallibility. Now, there was two things that came out of it. One was infallibility of the Pope. So what that means is when the Pope is in an official capacity or ex cathedra, that means what he says is infallible and immutable, can't be changed. And he doesn't need consent of the church. So he can make this unilateral decision, right? So he did that with Mary, for example. And I think one misconception, if you guys have heard this before, which I thought I had heard too, is that some people just think, oh, the Pope, whatever the Pope says, it's infallible. Catholics don't believe that. Catholics believe that when he's ex cathedra, then what he says is infallible and he's enabled by the Holy Spirit. And that's actually only hope happened twice in Catholic history. So one is with the Immaculate Conception, and the second time is with what they call the Assumption, which is later on in 1950. So that was one thing that was established, the infallibility of the Pope ex cathedra. And the second thing was, again, the primacy. The Pope is the vicar of Christ. He's the successor of Peter. And so he has just basically full authority over the church, over all the bishops. He has, you know, this extends to faith, to morals, to administration. So it just, again, just reinforced the power of the position and kind of codified it. I mean, a lot of this stuff was already, it's not like it just came up out of nowhere. It had been going on for centuries, but this essentially just declared it as doctrine, essentially. Does that all make sense so far? Okay, good. So that's Italy. Now we're going to move on to England. So England, there was a lot going on as well. Now, this around this time was the Industrial Revolution. So the Industrial Revolution, as you guys may have heard, is where there was a lot of shifting to the cities. There was steam power that was discovered, and there's a lot more industry that happened. And so London became actually the largest financial center of the world. And a lot of the stuff was kind of going on. But in the countryside, there was a little, what they call a sect, which was actually just a group of friends. And they called it the Clapham sect. So one of the leaders, supposedly the probably the most well-known, is William Wilberforce. And if you guys have ever seen the movie Amazing Grace, that's kind of about him and his abolition of the slave trade. But anyways, this Clapham sect was a group of friends, Christian friends, that sought to address a lot of the wrongs and injustices of their countries. And a lot of them actually came from positions of power. They had wealth, and a lot of them were educated. And William Wilberforce actually was very eloquent, and he himself was really rich. And so they ended up, one of the issues that they ended up targeting was slavery. And slavery went all the way back to the 1500s. And at this point, there was up to over 100,000 slaves that were being transported from West Africa yearly. So basically, Wilberforce was the primary speaker. So he made a speech in front of Parliament in 1789. So, and then he made another speech again. And so if you guys have seen the movie, but you would know that also, you know, initially there was a lot of hesitation. A lot of people didn't really buy into the whole abolition, but eventually the tides began to turn and public support started mounting and more people started leaning towards abolition of the slave trade. And so the tides took a while to turn, but it took about 18 years. And so finally in 1807, the House Parliament decided to halt the slave trade. And it was said that William Wilberforce just broke down crying, which I don't blame him. I'm sure that was just a sweet moment for him. So this was 18 years after his first speech. And so this halted the transport of slaves, but you know what? It didn't actually halt slavery itself. It didn't abolish slavery completely. It just halted the transport of slaves. And so Wilberforce, even after this point, will continue to fight for slaves and for them to be freed completely, which did happen in 1833, and that's 4 days before he died. So that was, again, very just awesome that he was able to somewhat hear about it before he died. I'm supposing, actually, that he heard about it. But anyways, it was in 1833. So also going on at this time, besides, you know, the slavery, there was also a lot of the start of missions that was starting to go on. And the reason today, like, I'm focusing mostly on Europe and America, and you guys may have thought about this too, like, wait, why are we focusing? What about other places like China and Africa and South America? How come we don't talk about those places? Well, the truth is Protestant Christianity didn't really exist a whole lot, as far as we know, outside of America and the Europe. So in that time, the 19th century, Africa was still considered, quote, the dark continent. There wasn't as much gospel, except for perhaps a few in Egypt, Ethiopia, the Copts. They call it C-O-P-T-S, the Copts, Coptics. And then maybe in India and Africa, in India and Asia and the East Indies, where the Dutch had taken their industries. And so there was some churches in those areas, but really there wasn't a whole lot of Christianity in those areas. And so William Carey, he was a cobbler, made shoes, and he just saw the huge need for development of ministries in other parts of the world, and he wanted Christianity to be ingrained there. And to his credit, he saw the need not just for people to turn people and turn these people from other cultures into what they were like, but he was just wanted to train up the people there to basically give them the gospel and basically allow them to have the same culture. And I think a lot of ways there have been times, you know, this has been done wrongly in terms of missionaries, where it's like if you became a believer, you almost had to become a European, or you had to act that way, you had to dress a certain way. And so I think Carey saw the need for that. But anyways, you would think nowadays we have missions, we all support missions, and it seems like the right thing to do, right? The Great Commission, I mean, it just makes sense. But interesting, there were a lot of Calvinists back then that thought that this is not congruent with election. I mean, it's like God had elected people, and, you know, why, like, if we're just going to go out there and mass evangelize people, that doesn't seem consistent because God's just going to choose people. So in a form, in a way, this is kind of like a hyper-Calvinistic view, which means a lot of times people will throw that term out, meaning we don't need to evangelize because God's going to save whoever he's going to save, right? You guys may have heard that, but of course that's taking it the wrong way. Anyways, he found a friend in Andrew Fuller. So you guys may have heard of Fuller Seminary in Southern California, but basically Fuller, he and him teamed up. They saw passages in the Bible, including Philippians and other places, where it's like, God's going to be a God of all tribes and tongues and nations. And so what are we doing about that? And so he formed the Baptist Missionary Society with 11 other Baptists in the end of the 18th century, 1792. And then within a year, Carey was on his way to India. He didn't waste time. He basically went there quickly. But there was, again, opposition. The British East India Company didn't want missionaries there. They didn't like that idea. So they actually refused him to have permission to live in Calcutta. So he actually ended up going to another place in India called Serampore. And so he actually did that under the Danish flag, even though he was British. So he was joined by two other families in 1799. And these three families worked hard, and they learned the Hindu culture and the languages. And Terry's actually a pretty amazing guy. He learned, he learned the language within 5 years, pretty much Sanskrit, one of the languages, I should say, and translated the whole Bible into Bengali. And by the end of his life, he translated the Bible into at least parts of it into 36, they said about 36 languages. And so he was, he's often called the father of modern missions. And he can be attributed to have launched the modern missionary movement. And so after him, quickly followed a lot of other people. So Henry Martin to India, he translated the Bible into Hindustani, Arabic, Persian. Robert Morrison, Hudson Taylor in China, Adoniram Judson to Burma, Robert Movat, South Africa, David Livingston, he went to Africa and actually worked hard to also abolish the slave trade there. But, you know, these are the names we know. There's a lot of other missionaries that went, and we will never know their names because a lot of them would died within a few months of arriving at the places they went to, either because of tropical diseases or sometimes the savage tribes would actually kill them. So, you know, God knows, obviously, but these are the big names that we know, but there was certainly a lot of zeal for missions and for the gospel to go forth. And so because of these people's influence, by the end of the 19th century, almost virtually every Christian body had some type of missionary involvement, which is awesome. And every country and a lot of these organizations, including Salvation Army. But you just look, just at in Finland, Italy, Russia, all over the place, they all had some involvement in missions. So pretty remarkable how quickly that grew. And one thing under this part, you can see on top of page three here, is there was this new concept in some ways of voluntary societies. Now, you know, typically people, even nowadays, we typically work with people under our common, you know, denominations, right? Or common theology and things like that. But there was in some ways a branching out from that. These people, there was these societies that actually united under certain goals and certain topics instead of by denomination. So, for example, the London Missionary Society, one of their sayings was that their fundamental principle is our design is not to send Presbyterianism, Independency, Episcopacy, or any other form of church government, but the glorious gospel of the blessed God to the heathen. So that was their little motto that they said, which I think reflects what we're saying. And so it is kind of a something that popped up there. And so that was something that popped up as well. And also just one more note about missions is this was different. If we think back to the few centuries that we've covered, a lot of times, you know, after the first few centuries, what happened was that you started getting mass conversions, right? People started getting converted by, in essence, almost by force or by state. I think outside of Acts, where you see, you know, the church growing amazingly and, you know, God totally multiplying the people, a lot of the centuries after that, it was basically forced conversion. And it's like you became Christian because that's what your state said, or that's what the church, right, said. And there was consequences. But at this point, you know, the missionary societies was totally voluntary. It was, you know, we want to make these people, we want to proclaim the gospel, and there was religious freedom. And so, and the a lot of the endeavors were not just financed by the church per se, by the wealthy, but even a lot of the everyday congregants. And I think that was pretty neat too. That was kind of a shift as well. And so, again, we can kind of see some of these, how these things influence us even nowadays, how, you know, a lot of people will support missionaries, yes, as a church, but also even individually. And so I think back then that was fairly new concept. So
We have a question for you.
Yeah.
Kinda, if I can. Yeah. This is really interesting, and I want to sort of go back a little bit to where you're talking about that, like the London Missionary Society, and they're saying like we don't want to spread Presbyterianism or whatever. So it's kind of a lightening of the emphasis of denominational distinctives. What do you think might be both like the pros and the cons of that kind of approach? And one thing I hear that, and that sounds a lot like we have a lot of parachurch organizations, right? Like non-church Christian organizations and missions and like campus ministries and all kinds of things. So what do you think might be the pros and cons of that kind of approach?
Yeah. So obviously we know I think the pros obviously is if it's getting the gospel out there and the true gospel, then it is a blessing in that sense, of course, that these people are working together, putting aside differences to work towards a common goal. But I think the cons, which kind of is a caveat, I think oftentimes is there has to be enough of a commonality. You can't discard important doctrines to compensate in that way. So like, for example, if we were to, I mean, this is kind of an extreme example, but let's just say us and Jehovah's Witnesses, which we know are, a cult, then that wouldn't work just because they say they believe in Jesus. But even let's just say they're not even Jehovah's Witnesses, but let's say Presbyterians, maybe there are slightly different doctrines that might become an issue, like infant baptism or other things like that. So I think that can lead to conflict and that can lead to confusion. And so that could be definitely a con. So it has to be done. I think there has to be a certain degree of commonality in terms, at least with doctrine. I think sometimes what can be compromised a little bit more, I think what in these people compromised more was not on the doctrine per se, but more on how the church governments was, it sounded like. It was more of structure things, which again are important. Don't get me wrong, but I feel they, from what I can understand, it wasn't like compromising on, oh, well, I think this people believe that you had to be baptized to be saved, and these people believe, you have to not be baptized. So I think major doctrines, they have to be in line. Is that?
Yeah, so if you could say like they would agree on essentials of the faith, but maybe disagree on things that are potentially still quite important and not essential. And just, yeah, that is a tension in terms of cooperation that we still deal with today of just, there is a lot of, yeah, I appreciate that. It was helpful.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, that was a good question. All right. Let me see. All right. Okay. All right. Well, let me see here. Any other kind of questions before I keep going? I know I'm kind of just going through this, flying through this. Okay. Looks like no, I can't see. Okay. If there is, let me know, cause I can't see the raising of the hands and things like that. Okay. So we're going to move to America. Sorry. Give me a second here. Okay. So America here now, the 19th century, 1800s, this was a fairly young nation. We were fairly young. We just declared independence. And so there were a lot of new things that were going on, right? We were on the east, mostly on the east coast, and so there was starting to be spreading towards heading west. And there was a preacher, which I'll come back to later. His name is Lyman Beecher. He was a preacher in New England. He said, there's a vast empire opening up America in the wilderness, and Christians just have a great opportunity now to shape the religious and political destiny of the U.S. And so at this time, like I said, more and more states started being added to the United States. And interestingly, there wasn't actually a lot of people attending church. There was estimates that it was only between 5 to 10% of the American people were church members. So somewhat low. And so the what changed that somewhat was the Second Great Awakening, like I mentioned at the beginning. And now this started around 1800. And it started in kind of centered around Mississippi, Kentucky, Tennessee areas. And there was a lot of preachers, but there was one guy named Reverend James McGreedy. And he was a big Calvinist, and he had these fiery sermons that really drew a lot of people, and many people came out to hear him. And he kind of basically called for almost like a revival. He called for a meeting at this place. They call it the Gasper River Church. And some people came as far as like 100 miles just to hear him. And they brought, you know, food and just to kind of for a multi-day event, essentially. And this is considered one of the first quote unquote camp meetings, essentially multi-day religious services where people travel to. And it's kind of the precursor to nowadays, like somewhat like certain crusades or things like Billy Graham, what Billy Graham did, Charles Finney and Moody. And so it was just a calling for a bunch of people to gather and they hear preaching essentially. The Lutherans and the Presbyterians at that time, actually, they thought they didn't really like the idea. They thought it avoided a lot of sound doctrine and that maybe it was too emotional based. And so, again, we can see certain things similar at times in that, you know, in our culture where we might think, oh, wait a second, this seems a little bit too focused on, you know, just kind of charismatic, like, you know, whipping up the emotions type of thing. But regardless, I think, you know, God used that preacher and those events and brought many people to him and back to church and things like that. And so one of the populations actually that also really grew in terms of, I guess you could say, religiosity, but was basically the slaves. I mean, the slaves at this time, you know, they were being transported from Africa, and a lot of them had been deprived of, I mean, everything, unfortunately, their livelihood, their culture, and even their, like their gods. A lot of them were gods. So interesting, a lot of them turned to the Bible, and that's the, you know, that was, they turned to the Bible, and there was over 2 million slaves here in America by 1830s. And the masters of the slaves actually debated whether that was a good thing or not, because some of them just thought, oh, they might read the Bible and decide, oh, you know, there's no reason for me to, I shouldn't be a slave. I need to, you know, everyone's equal, essentially. So some masters were actually quite afraid of this whole concept of slaves being reading the Bible or at least hearing the Bible preached. But then there's other masters that actually could use the Bible to justify slavery. They thought the Bible, you see slavery in a lot in the Old Testament and other places, they just thought, hey, you know, the Bible sanctions slavery essentially, which is unfortunate. So at this point there was the growth of what they call like these Negro preachers. And so the preachers would actually have a huge lot of influence over the slaves, and it gave them a lot of, you know, the slaves hope and community. And so that was a big phenomenon that was happening. And earlier I mentioned Lyman Beecher. He was one of the famous preachers. His daughter, one of his, I believe, 13 children, was Harriet Beecher Stowe. You guys know that name. She wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And so quite influential book, obviously. And so during this time, there was all this stuff was happening, and the slave trade, just like we talked about in England, was being, you know, debated, and depending on, again, where you lived in the North. And essentially the Civil War was coming, and it, of course, it happened. And Abraham Lincoln, as you guys may know from American history, was the president. And Lincoln himself apparently never really joined the church, but he was definitely influenced by evangelical thought and Christian thinking. And so he basically was dismayed in many ways how Christians could see the Bible so differently to either justify slavery or to say it's, you know, he just thought it was interesting and kind of sad that people could use the Bible in different ways. And again, I would say that's still prevalent nowadays. We can be sad that people misuse the Bible. So that was what happened. Civil War was fought. Obviously, we know what happened, and the North won. And essentially, over time, by the mid-1800s, there was that full abolition of slavery. So a lot of that stuff, you know, a lot of the abolition did happen from state to state. It did take time, but it was in the 19th century where it was fully declared. And some of you guys may be obviously acutely aware of that, especially with all the events going on recently with, you know, the political riots and the racism discussions and everything. So actually quite appropriate. So any questions so far there? Okay. So, all right. So now we're going to move on then to the challenges to scripture. Okay. So now Charles Darwin comes on the scene. He wrote the book Origin of Species in 1859. And he was influenced by another guy as well. I think his name was, let's see here, Lyell. Charles Lyell, and who also was a geologist and had written some stuff about evolution. And so that was quite, it did influence him. But he wrote in this book basically proposing the evolutionary theory. And there was another follow-up book that not as many people know about a few years after that. It was 1871. It was called The Descent of Man. And that's where it was laid out that our ancestors may actually be monkey-like animals, might be primates, right? And so this was where it all kind of, started where, a lot of the evolutionary theory got big. So when this happened, of course, you can imagine how would a Christian respond to all this? I mean, for thousands of years, it was never a big issue that God created the world. And now you're saying we evolved from primates, maybe, right? And so Christians had to really force to think about this. And maybe you guys have, you yourselves have kind of thought through this as well. But how do you reconcile evolution, and is it true, or is it something that we can actually fit in with the Bible, or are they inherently contradictory, right? And so a lot of times there were certain questions that just basically try to reconcile it, that you can say, well, there is evolution, but then there's also the Bible is also true too, and so they try to mesh those together. Again, you'll find Christians nowadays like that. You yourselves may have certain thoughts about that as well, but essentially that was where this whole evolutionary theory kind of crept in. And so there was starting to be challenging of the historical events of the Bible. Now that's one thing, but then when someone starts challenging the Bible itself and starts criticizing and thinking about the Bible, now this is, again, a huge thing that started happening as well. And so this is called theological liberalism, okay? So theological liberalism kind of fell on two kind of shaky grounds, you could say. One was Christian experience, like the importance of Christian experience. And then the other one was just on modern thought, essentially. And both of them were kind of shaky. But I like how I have this quote from a guy named Niebuhr, and he kind of sums it up fairly well. But he says, at this point, a God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through ministrations of a Christ without a cross. So kind of like everything was up for grabs, and a lot of things that were historically believed started being challenged. So basically all the things, there was nothing really off the table on what's being challenged. And so, Friedrich Schleiermacher, he was one of the philosophers, and he was actually more in Germany, but so kind of going back to Europe now, but he saw, European Christianity just basically out of touch with modern times. And so he's the kind of a classic example of theological liberalism. So he wrote a book, and he redefined how what faith looks like and how one relates to God. And he said, religion is primarily about your feeling of dependence on God. And Jesus came simply just to model that, you know, about feeling our dependence on God. And the church is just a group of people with the same kind of feelings, the same common experience. Experience is what really, really mattered to to him. And so in many ways, I'm sure, again, if you guys want to share, how do we see that even in today's society about how the emphasis of experience? Maybe I'll just ask that question first.
One thing, Chinwe, is that sometimes if someone tries to make a truth claim that's supposed to be like objectively true, it'll be challenged on the ground of whether or not the person saying it has had certain experiences. So it's like, you can't say that because, and even if it's not a statement about one's own experience, it can just be kind of judged right out the gate based on whether you've experienced what I've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like maybe you said, I got this vision or something, or I heard something, and you'll say, well, that's not biblical. And they'll say, well, don't judge my experience, kind of something like that, maybe.
Yeah. Or even like a truth claim, like something being a sin. And then someone saying, kind of getting back and saying, oh, if you knew what it was like, you know what I mean? Like if you had the experience X, you wouldn't believe that. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of becomes the way that often we define, or hopefully not we, but the way many in our culture define what can and can't be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Anybody else have any thoughts on that in terms of how Christian circles sometimes have leaned heavily on experience to the detriment?
Chinwe.
Yeah.
I think in part, one thing that you're describing is, in essence, a large part of, you know, what we may say is the charismatic movement. Obviously, it's a large group, a lot of variations in it, but unfortunately, with some sections of that group, there's a lot of emphasis on the experience. Say, oh, you know, I feel like God's speaking to me or something, but ultimately, it's an emphasis of experience over what God has actually written in His Word. Sometimes, you know, what they might say, you know, could be, you know, inspirational, so to speak. Like, oh, you know, I feel like God has, you know, He told me that, you know, I need to go, you know, go across the street to my neighbor and, you know, preach the gospel or something. And, you know, something, you know, that's wonderful. But other times it can be clearly contradictory to Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So there was a lot of emphasis on that. And if you take it a little bit further, you know, it ended up leading to the idea of something like, well, all religions are kind of just different expressions of the same inner religious experience, right? How many times have you guys heard that in different ways? Maybe it's like, well, all roads lead to the same thing, right? I think we all kind of want to believe the same thing, but we just call them different gods, right? You guys might have heard that in a very kind of pluralistic way. And so that's where theological liberalism kind of had a root into all that. And so again, one side of the theological liberalism is this part of it, the experience part. Again, you can see how that we've talked about how that can be kind of shaky. And the other side is, again, coping with the adjustments with modern thought. Again, kind of justifying how do we deal with all this science and all this new kinds of evolution theory and all these things, and how do you be relevant still in those times? And because it's almost like if we can't keep up with science, and you know, how do we talk to intelligent people? And still, again, we still have a lot of those same challenges, different times. But that started all the way back in the 19th century, and of course, even before then. But so, anyways, like I said a little bit earlier, every doctrine started being challenged, and sovereignty of God, depravity of man, heaven and hell? Is there a reality of that? Do we need the Holy Spirit to actually be converted? Even the atonement of Jesus, right? And so this started being challenged. And when I put the biblical criticism, so a lot of the universities, they started analyzing the Bible, and something they call lower criticism is basically saying, oh, well, was it really translated correctly? Is that what the text originally said? And then there was even something called higher criticism, which is, well, what does it really mean? Did things really, you know, they started questioning the original meanings of what texts meant. And so, you know, you can see how that would be so harmful if you start questioning even original meanings. And again, we see that oftentimes nowadays too. So it's kind of like, just for example, I'll just give one example where some people thought, oh, well, the Israelites, you know, they were pretty barbaric before. They killed all their enemies. They slaughtered their enemies, but it was kind of an evolutionary process. Eventually they got better. They saw God as a just, merciful God. Eventually they kind of realized their ways. Eventually they came to Jesus, and oh, now, you know, became kind of more loving in that side, right? So it's almost, that was kind of one of the things, for example, that's just one example of how people would reinterpret the Bible without having a good base of biblical theology, especially when you start criticizing and when you start criticizing a lot of these core doctrines. And just one thing is, the Bible is no longer considered authoritative. You need outside sources to show, to prove the Bible. So, right, there's basically, it's not enough to say the Bible is the Bible. And again, we see that nowadays, you know, that it's like, you tell people the Bible, well, I don't believe the Bible. Like, oh, now you have to justify that. That never used to be a big issue in the past, in the, you know, centuries, you know, prior to that, a lot, you know, it would seem to be less of an issue, I should say, not never an issue, but so that was something that was huge. Okay. And then just the last few minutes, I'm just going to talk, I'm not going to go too much into this, but industrialization. So there was, like I said, the Industrial Revolution happening in Europe, but in America too. And there was a lot of immigrants that are streaming in from Europe and to America. And this influence, actually, this mixing of cultures, actually changed how a lot of Protestants view their Bible and view their country. And there was becoming more of a blending, melting pot in many ways. And so I think at this point, there was some big names, including Karl Marx, Marxism. And you guys may have learned about him. He's often associated with communism, but there was also not just there was a lot of sociological and economic implications in terms of wanting the lower classes, what they call the proletariat, having more power, and where all the higher middle class, the bourgeoisies, seem to have too much power. And so we wanted kind of like equalization. And the church actually started getting involved in somewhat in this. And, you know, there's obviously some good things, like we talked about earlier, that, like, you know, what Carey and a lot of these people did in terms of justice issues and slavery, and a lot of humanitarian things that the missionaries did, establishing hospitals and teaching agricultural practices. So it's not a bad thing that Christians were involved in humanitarian acts. But I think what the social gospel really was saying is that God's saving work is including corporate structures now, not just personal lives, but God's for a Christian, we should be involved in changing corporate structures in reconstruction of social order, essentially. And that's part of our religious responsibility. And so, you know, we may have heard that term, social gospel, nowadays, and sometimes in the Reformed circle, it's kind of used a little bit as a negative way. But of course, there's positive things about it. But again, the nuance, I think, oftentimes is this the gospel? Do we reform society? Is that our main task? And again, I think this is a very relevant question that a lot of people are having to face, even again, in light of what's been going on recently. Like, how much does a Christian get involved in trying to change government and social structures, right? And political involvement. And so at that time, that's where a lot of the rise of social gospel and the involvement of churches and Christians into to the corporate kind of world. So that's kind of like the general gist of it. And again, we can see kind of a lot of influences that carrying over into to the 20th century and now. So that's pretty much that. Any questions?
I want to put you on the hot seat for a couple of things, a couple of really good things you brought up. If you wouldn't mind taking a stab on slavery, because you said, you know, Christians were using the Bible to defend it, right? In the, like in the years leading up to and including the Civil War, and other Christians were using the Bible to try to end it. And Lincoln goes, this is a mess. You know, there are people using the Bible from both sides. How should we as Christians think about that? How the Bible was used, you know, in defense of slavery? Was that a right interpretation? Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to take a stab at it without. So
only as much as you feel comfortable.
Yeah. So I think, okay. So I think, you know, the Bible obviously has certain things that are, you know, just because something's in the Bible doesn't mean it's prescriptive, right? A lot of times it's descriptive. It's a sign of the fallenness of man, right? Mm-hmm. Just because the Bible describes polygamy doesn't mean we should all be polygamists. It was kind of a sign of human fallenness. And just because there was slavery doesn't mean that it was okay. Just even same with divorce, right? I think it's kind of like the Pharisees went to Jesus, hey, you know, what would be okay to divorce? And he's like, it's not like that God wanted you guys to divorce. He just allowed it because of your hardness of hearts. And so in some ways, slavery was an unfortunate consequence of course, people grabbing power. And, you know, we've seen that from the beginning of time, you know, when someone, you know, what's the saying that power, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it's essentially, it's a testimony of human behavior. And so I think to justify just because it's in the Bible, I don't think that's right. Because it's never, I don't think it's, yeah, it's not like go take slaves. I mean, I think there are certain hard passages in the Bible that talk about slaves, like obeying your masters and things like mm-hmm. that in the New Testament. But I wouldn't say it's sanctioning mm-hmm. slavery in any sense of the word. That's kind of my initial thoughts. Hopefully that's
helpful. Yeah, that's helpful. And I would say too, like, there's maybe sort of a near horizon and a far horizon. Like the near word for the slave in the congregation Paul's writing to is you submit to your master. But then there's maybe a longer term sense in which the whole Christian gospel would undermine the foundations of slavery as it did historically. Like if there's this unity we have in Christ, where there's no slave or free, there's no Greek or Jew. And even just the more basic with our neighbor of like, we're all made in God's image and affirming that, you kind of see that in Philemon, how the broader strokes of the gospel and Christianity kind of eat away at the foundations of slavery in a society. Mm. So yeah, so it's, that's just complementing your point about, you know, it's not like the Bible is telling us to do slavery. It's kind of like the Paul just speaking to people, that's the situation they're in. Right. So.
Yeah. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I remember researching before, it was that Christians, I mean, comparatively to a lot of the surrounding cultures, most of the time were very, had to treat their slaves kindly. And I believe there's a lot of laws about protection of the slaves, which was a lot more foreign to other cultures, let's say surrounding Israel and other things like that. So actually, they had to respect their slaves, and you know, there was punishment for, like, there was actually some value on life versus some of the other cultures. Kind of like, well, it's completely your property; I can do whatever I want with my slaves.
Right.
So there is still, it's not an ideal. dynamic, but there was actually God's heart even for protection of slaves.
Yeah, like in ancient Israel, right? That key distinction between absolute property versus another image bearer of God was you did see that in the law. So, yeah. That's good.
Yeah, good question.
Good answer.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Any other kind of thoughts, questions? I think there was a lot. If you guys have any thoughts on any of it. Speak now or forever hold your peace. You guys can always email me and and so I think we're going to have our last one next week, 20th century. But yeah, hopefully this was enjoyable for you guys. Actually, it was pretty enjoyable for me to learn about all these movements and all these people that God has used over the years and things like that. So, yeah.
Wait, I had a question.
Yeah.
You're talking about ex cathedra with the Pope. How did they know that it was implemented or that that they had it? Was it just because the Pope said it's ex cathedra, so you have to listen to what I say, or did they have some other support system that was implemented this, if that makes sense?
Do you mean how did the Catholics know at the time of that time know that it was ex cathedra?
Yeah.
I think the Pope just declared it and people accepted it. And I think with the whole, it was kind of, and this, I can be wrong about this, but I think it might have been slightly retroactive too. It's like when they voted on the papal infallibility, it's kind of like, okay, well now we've really said whenever the Pope really speaks on an issue by himself and he's dictating that, then it is ex cathedra. So it's kind of so what the Pope declared back in 1854, was it, about 1854, about the Immaculate Conception, now is ex cathedra. I don't know if they used those terms widely at that time, and I don't know also when it happened again in 1950, whether, the Pope said, hey, this is what the Holy Spirit has told me, and I'm just going to say, this is going to be now doctrine. I would have to ask, I would have to research it or ask someone.
Thank you.
You know, Tim, or no?
No, I know it means from the chair. So it'd just be from that, some official vantage point of, but yeah, it's a good point that you make that the doctrine was crystallized after the act happened. But it seems like it must have been the Pope was meaning to make a very official pronouncement. This is not like what the Pope chatting with his friends and then it's like it becomes, yeah. So it must have been some form of an official pronouncement at the time that they then said, okay, well, this is divine authority, essentially.
I can ask my coworker tomorrow. She told me last time, because when I learned about the Catholic ex cathedra, I was like, oh, that doesn't make sense. How come the Pope is infallible in everything he says? And she says something to me like, well, it's actually not that way. It's he's only used it a few times, or the Pope has only used it. I was like, oh, really? That's interesting. And this was 3 years ago when she said that to me. So I'd be interested to see what she says on how they determine that. But I don't know. It's a good question, though. Okay, well, I think that's all I have. If you guys, again, have any questions, feel free to email me. I'll try my best, or I'll try to pass you on to someone else that can answer it.
Thanks, okay. Brother. Sounds all good. Right. Thanks, Chinwe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chinwe. You did great.
All right. Happy Father's Day to those fathers. Bye.